13th. I don't know if this is number 4 or 5.
Thank you. Oh, you got two. It's still Shehakol.
All right. In the last few weeks, we've discussed the concepts of Derech Eretz, of Midos Tovos, of good character, of mitzvahs that are between man and fellow man, and we are now going to discuss how the principles that we spoke about, how they shape the entire life of direction of both individuals and, in a sense, of society, and even, in a sense, Jewish history. Right? How these principles shape that. I just want to make one brief comment. Last week, when I told the story of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, how he had a cat go into his house to protect the books from the mice on Yom Kippur, so somebody made a comment that it seemed like that's overdoing a little bit. So the simple answer to that would be that it's hard to imagine how they lived. I mean, the mice were constantly, I'm sure, in the houses. But even aside from that, that's part of the point of what we're trying to discuss over here, that becoming sensitive to other people's belongings and other people's feelings, for that matter, at such a level is a great thing. It's not overdone. We're trying to become as sensitive as we can to other people's belongings. And if Rabbi Salanter, I'm sure most people wouldn't have done something like that. But because he was so sensitized to other people's belongings and to the property of somebody else, he wanted to remove any risk as far as he could from something happening to them, because when he's in the house, first of all, the mice don't come as much when he's in the house, but also he's there to chase them away. But to leave the house empty for a whole day, I'm assuming in Lithuania, in the type of place that they live, probably meant that there were rodents around. I'm assuming so.
Amen.
In 1978, December of 1978, a great man named Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz, he was the head of the yeshiva of the Mir of Jerusalem, passed away. And he was one of the most sensitive people that I've read about in my life. Many, many stories about him. And he has a wonderful book of Musar lessons from the different Torah portions. And he writes there that a person is held accountable if he doesn't regularly re-examine the path that the person is on in terms of his own midos. Sometimes we get so, we just become accustomed to doing something, and I'm not talking politics over here. I'm talking about midos. I'm talking about character. That we just become accustomed to doing something, and we're convinced that it's good, or we're convinced that we're doing the right thing. And like anything that runs regularly, it needs to be checked up. Some things need a tune-up, whatever, right? We have to check ourselves also, says Reb Chaim, to make sure that what we're doing, even the good things that we're doing, that we're doing them properly. And if not, he said, if a person doesn't do that, so oftentimes a person is held responsible because a person can even be doing good things and be doing them in a way that's harmful. We'll speak a little bit about that today. And another idea is that if we're not guided, and this is not just talking about ways of pleasantness or Derech Eretz and Midos that we've been talking about the last few weeks, but in general, that if we're not checking in, what is it that the Almighty wants from us? So our lives can be full of contradictions. Our lives are full of contradictions. I think that's fairly clear. But certain contradictions that are more harmful than others, and that one would be held responsible for things more than others. So just as an example, I was listening to a live lecture recently that was coming out of Jerusalem, and somebody was asking the rabbi for some clarity on certain issues regarding abortion. Right? It's coming up in the news again a lot now. It's having... If you don't believe in resuscitation of the dead, just look at the abortion issue. You can see it. It's coming back up. And the rabbi said something very interesting. And I'm not going into the issues of abortion per se. The rabbi just said a very interesting thing. He said that you can have people who are vegan or vegetarian because they're concerned about the life of the animal. They don't believe that animal research should be done for helping a human being. They wouldn't step on a bug if they don't have to. And these same people are not against taking the life of a fetus, the life of a fetus with a beating heart, right? And in some cases, even after the baby's born. But let's assume just now while the baby's a fetus. Right? And again, I'm not talking halacha over here, when and what, right? He said, how could it be? Because somebody thinks that it's a part of a body and therefore they should have a choice that gives you a right to take a life? Right? So he was just saying that people need to look into themselves and see the contradiction. This is not politics. We're not arguing the issue. And I'm not talking about why. That's a fact. What I just said now is factual. It's factual. There are people who hold this, and at the same time, they can be pro-abortion. They can give all kinds of excuses why they're pro-abortion, but that's the reality. And it's a confusion. If a person does not have a guide, if a person just, that's what we call humanism, a person makes decisions based on what they feel is right and what they feel is proper. God gave us a brain, and we're supposed to use this to think, but we were also given a Torah. And Torah is not easy. One has to seek out what is it that the Almighty wants of us and how we should come to such decisions. And I just use one example, but it's like that in all areas of life. We are full of contradictions. And to the extent that we can, we should really try to live in alignment. Now, we're not perfect. We're going to live with contradictions, right? But one needs to check in, even on one's good deeds, are they contradictory or not? So, as we continue today, we'll talk about, we'll give some examples of that. Interesting thing, Reb Chaim says, the first thing a person should do in trying to come to be able to make correct decisions is ask God for enlightenment. Ask Him to give you the right ideas, to expose you to the right teachings, to the proper books, whatever it might be. Ask the Almighty for help, that I should be able to come. Because a lot of times we don't know. People make decisions all the times in life based on media, based on where the masses are going, what the public says, and oftentimes that has nothing to do with right or wrong. People just, they sort of, you know, they follow the tide. Whatever way the tide is going, that's the way they tend to go. Jews have been, since the beginning of time as Jews have been swimming against the tide. If we would have followed the masses in many things, we wouldn't be here anymore. And the next thing that a person has to check into is the verse says in Tehillim, Pikudei Hashem Yisharim Mesamchei Lev. The dictates, the things that God speak about are Yisharim. They're straightforward. That those things reflect integrity. They reflect uprightness. Do the mitzvahs that I do. I'm not talking about the negative things that I do. Do the mitzvahs that I do reflect uprightness? If not, then even things that are seemingly good could be at odds with the will of Hashem. I'll give you an example that can happen in any given shul on any Shabbos, just as an example. And then we'll talk about a little bit, as I said, that these ideas sort of shaped Jewish history. Ideally, a person should be davening in shul, try to get the same seat every time. The same area, the same basic area. It's good. You're not, you know, distracted by other people. You're not checking what's going on. It's a good idea to have, even if you're at home, by the way, and you're davening at home, it's a good idea to have a constant and consistent place to daven, because you're more focused. You know, this is my place of davening. It doesn't have to be always the exact seat or the exact place. You come to shul on Shabbos morning, right? And there's a guest. And they're sitting in your seat. Right? So, I mean, it seems simple, but you don't, right? But you paid a lot for that seat. And that's the only place that you can sit that you can actually see over the mechitza, and you can see what you really want to be there for, right? But a person can say, I have to have my makom kavua, I have to have my place. Excuse me, sir, this is where I sit. Right? So what you've just done is you've taken something that is not absolutely necessary. You don't have to sit there. It's a good thing to be able to sit. And because of your frumkeit, you've just insulted somebody, maybe discouraged somebody from ever coming back, maybe pushed somebody out of shul. There are many, many examples like that of things that people do.
I just have to tell you, I went to a new exercise class, and someone said, came up to me and said, you're standing in my spot.
That's why I used this example.
I couldn't believe that.
Did you know that there was you didn't know that there was a mitzvah to stay in the same spot for exercise class?
I didn't know.
That's cute.
But that lady wasn't Jewish.
Right.
That was, yes, she was.
Anyway, so there are many, many examples like that where a person is trying to do something. They think that they're doing something good, and they wind up doing it at the expense of menschlichkeit, of derech eretz, right? Obviously, a mitzvah cannot be rejected, can't be done away with. If I have to do something, I have to do it, but you do it in the most inconspicuous manner if you think other people are going to laugh at it. You're not supposed to look like a fool in the eyes of other people, but it's something that has to be done. I'll give you an example. Today, I don't think it's such a big deal, but I've spoken about this before, putting on tefillin in the airport. There was a time when I was uncomfortable with it, but it had to be done, not to be done. So people think you're foolish, so that's, you know, that's their problem. If I needed to do it, I needed to do it. Also, one time, Rabbi Ben-Zion Twersky from Milwaukee was here, and he said a story, and he said, if somebody were to pay you $10,000, $500,000, $1 million, not to put on tefillin one day, would you do it? The answer is absolutely not. I wouldn't bypass that. You can pay me whatever you want. I mean, I wouldn't bypass that. Tefillin is just a part of my life, and I wouldn't bypass it. How about if somebody paid you $10,000 or $1 million to put on tefillin in the airport? Would you do it?
Sure.
I certainly would. Right? So why, if somebody's willing to pay you, you're willing to do it? If it's a mitzvah to do, you're not willing to do it? Right? So, you know, there should be a consistency of thinking over there. But in any case, the idea that we have is that Moshe, just in last week's parsha, Moshe had to take a census of the Jewish people. In the desert, the United States Postal Service was on strike, and he wasn't able to mail the census to all the people. So what God did was he told him that he should go around to all the tents, and he should enter, knock on the tent door, and you go in and you ask, you find out how many people from military age, from age 20 to 60, how many men are there, and that's how Moshe took the census. However, there was a problem, and that is that with the tribe of Levi, the census was not from 20 years and up. For the tribe of Levi, the census was from 30 days and up, because the count was a different count, right? So Moshe Rabbeinu thought to himself, I can't do that, because 30 days, there's women nursing in the tent, I might find them in a compromised position, they may not, you know, with a newborn baby, they may not be as presentable as they would normally be, and it's going to be embarrassing, they would have to sort of sacrifice something for them, or, you know, be in a compromising way. So he stood outside of the tent, and it said he stood outside each tent of the house of Levi, and God spoke to him and told him, there's this and this number of people in this tent. Moshe understood that within God, and apparently God agreed, that within God's command, there had to be, it can't be that God gave me a commandment where I wouldn't be able to apply the norms of Derech Eretz, of treating the family with dignity. And therefore, he made a decision, and he was correct, that this is what I need to do. Now, what would have happened if God wouldn't have come to him? I don't know. But God gave him the number by each tent, which means that he was acquiescing, and he was saying, this is the proper way that you should have done things. You're right. Now, why didn't God tell him outwardly? Why didn't God tell him in the first place, just for the tribe of Levi, stand outside.
Teach him a lesson.
Elaborate. He's looking for the human input. He wants Moshe to figure that out. He wants Moshe. He's in a sense testing, but in a sense this would be a test which is not like a right or wrong, a check. The word in Hebrew for test, David?
Mifchan.
That's an exam.
Bechina.
No, that's an exam. It's the same. Bechina. A nisayon.
Nisayon, oh.
Right?
Okay.
Nisayon is a test. What?
Experience.
No, a chavaya is an experience. A chavaya is an experience. It could be a double meaning.
It could be
a double meaning. But nisayon means a test.
Wait.
But it comes from the word nes. The root of the word is nes. Nisayon is a, which means a banner. It's something that you lift up a banner. A test is there not to see whether you got it right or wrong. If somebody never tests their limits, they can't grow. The only way you grow is if you're over here and now you test to see if you can go further. The only way you can grow in being able to lift more weights is to test yourself how far I can go, and then as you increase your strength, you're able to lift more and more in spirituality as well, in Jewish growth as well. You have a nisayon, you have a test that's to lift you. God is giving Moshe the opportunity over here. He's giving him a nisayon, not a test like, what, do you get it right or wrong? But it's actually, or do you know the information or not? It's a different type of test, yes? That Moshe should grow from the experience, oh, yes, I got that. And now I know that the right thing to do would be just to stand outside the tent. Another example of that would be at the end of the book of Numbers, at the end of Parashat Bamidbar, where God says to Moshe, he should go out and wage war with Midian, who had done evil to the Jewish people and they were a hindrance. And Moshe Rabbeinu goes and he asks Pinchas to lead the charge. Moshe will be in the background. He has questions. He'll daven for them, whatever. But Pinchas should be the lead general. Why? Because Midian provided Moshe with refuge for many, many years. When Moshe ran away from Egypt after he smote the Egyptian and Pharaoh wanted to kill him in the earlier years of the Egyptian experience in the book of Shemos, Moshe ran away. That's where he ran to Midian. He met Yisro. He met his wife. He was there for many, many years. And he said, how could I do battle against the country that was so hospitable to me for so many years? Now, of course, I would add that I would imagine that if Pinchas wasn't up for the job and Moshe was just trying sort of to pass it on and Pinchas wasn't up for it, it wouldn't have been acceptable. But we see again that the Almighty acquiesced and he said that Moshe did the right thing, because Moshe said it can't be that if there's somebody who's equally capable as I am, God wanted it done. In this case, he didn't want it done by me. Now, I don't know if I would be able to make that decision. Also, God doesn't communicate with me in that way. But Moshe clearly saw that and he said that was part of the command. Part of the command was that I should do what I need to do with Derech Eretz. Okay? The Torah and all that comes along with it are meant to elevate a person. They are meant to make the person greater, to refine their character, to refine the elements, the human elements, to allow soul to control body. That's what the mitzvahs are supposed to do. That's what the mitzvahs are supposed to do. Therefore, our sages say that a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, who doesn't have Derech Eretz, who doesn't behave like a mensch, the Gemara uses the term, it says She'em Bo Das, who doesn't have wisdom, but the commentators there say means he doesn't have the wisdom to behave like a mensch within his observance of mitzvahs. It's a very harsh term that's used for him. It says Nevela Tova Heimena. Heimenu. That means a carcass is better than he is. Because a carcass is a carcass. Here you have somebody who's masquerading as one thing and is really something else. Right? A carcass doesn't do any harm per se. A Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar who behaves in a way that people look at and are repulsed by it, or people think, oh, that's the way that a Talmud Chacham behaves, is far worse, because that brings dishonor to God, that brings dishonor to the Jewish people, and that brings dishonor to the Torah. So, on the one hand, it's a great thing to be a Talmud Chacham. Obviously, it's the, you know, the mark of the height of Jewish achievement. But not if it comes without the midos tovos, the good character, and the derech eretz that goes along with it. And as a matter of fact, as I say, if one is a Talmud Chacham and presents himself as a Torah scholar and then behaves inappropriately, so the disgrace and the shame that comes out of it for the Torah, for God, that turns people away. That turns people off. The truth is, it's an excuse. Right? Somebody sees a rabbi or an observant Jew who behaves inappropriately, says, ah, I don't want that. Right? But when was the last time? I'm not going to doctors anymore because this one cheated the system or this one made it. People don't say that. You go and you follow somebody who you trust. You find somebody else. It's an excuse. But the reality is that the Jew cannot provide excuses for other Jews or for the non-Jewish world, for that matter. Right? We have to behave in a way that represents us well. I want to... these are two ideas, how even Derech Eretz shaped our history. I want to show you how far it goes over here. The Gemara has a discussion over here. This is Tractate Sukkah, and you might not be surprised. It discusses the holiday of Sukkahs. And the Jews always knew, what do we use for the four species that we shake on Sukkah? So what are the four species that we shake? Lulav. The palm is the lulav.
Esrog.
And then you have the myrtle and the willow, the hadassim and the arovos. Right? So the Jews must have had that from Sinai in tradition, handed down from generation to generation, what we use. But the Talmud is trying to discern and extrapolate from different verses in the Torah, because the Torah, except for Arvei Nochal, which means the willows that grow by the water, the Torah doesn't say on any of them exactly what they are. You have to have the oral tradition to go along with it. Right? It says, Pri Eitz Hodah, the fruit of the tree of beauty. That's the Esrog. Right? The Gemara discusses, how do you know? Aren't there other beautiful fruit on trees? So the Gemara discusses that. And then Kapos Tamarim, palms of dates. How do you know what part of a date tree that is? How do you know what part of a palm tree that is? Yeah? Then there's the willow, and then there's something called the myrtle. We call it in Hebrew the hadas. So the Gemara, the way that the Torah discusses it, it says, anaf eitz avos, the branch of a tree that's, in Yiddish we say, I remember translating it as a kid, geflochten. Geflochten means like it's twisted, it's woven, right? And that's the way that the hadas is. You have one leaf here, one leaf here, one leaf here, and as you go up, the leaves grow in bunches of three. So listen to this, the Gemara. The Gemara is trying to decipher over here, to discern, how do we know that it is the myrtle that we're talking about? There are other options, because the Torah doesn't say specifically myrtle. Okay? So the Gemara says like this. The rabbis taught, when the Torah says the term a shoot of the plaited tree, he says the word plaited, not twisted, plaited, P-L-A-I-T-E-D, okay, refers to, it says that a species whose shoots cover its branches. That means, if you take a look at the hadas, it's fully covered with branches, as opposed to sometimes you'll see wood here and leaves sticking out. The hadas tree is fully covered with the leaves. Okay, unless they fall off, right? And then the Talmud asked, what species is this? So the Gemara says, it's the myrtle. Okay, because that's that type of leaf and tree. So the Gemara says, how do you know? Maybe it refers to an olive branch, which means apparently an olive branch is covered by long, densely grown leaves that completely cover it. So how do you know that it's a myrtle? Maybe it's an olive branch. So next time you come with your lulav, your esrig, your willows, and an olive branch, right? So the Gemara says it can't be, because the Torah says avos, they have to be required that they be plaited, and this condition is lacking in olive branch. Olive branches just grow straight out. They don't grow like plaited like the hadassim. I'm sorry, I don't have a picture of the hadassim here. Then the Gemara says maybe it refers to a chestnut branch. So it says over here that again, that's Rashi says chestnut. But Tosos argues and said the reference has to be to other species because the leaves of a chestnut tree are not plaited. So that answer would be too simple to ask that question that it should be a chestnut tree. You just said it has to be plaited. So it's not, but whatever branch it's referring to, and the Gemara says no, because it says that you have to have the tree's shoots covering its branches totally. And whatever branch we're talking about now, chestnut or other, the branch is not totally covered. So finally the Gemara says, Ve'ema hirduf. How do you know it's a willow? Maybe we're referring to something called hirduf. Now they don't have the English translation for hirduf. In the footnote, he gives numerous possibilities what the hirduf are. So the Gemara says a fascinating thing. The way of the name of this class is its ways are ways of pleasantness, right? That's what it's based on, the verse Drochel Darche Noam, the ways of the Torah are pleasant. The Gemara says, Amar Abaya, Drochel Darche Noam Veleka. The species must conform with general stipulation about the Torah that its ways are ways of pleasantness, and this condition is lacking in the Hirduf. Why? Because it has sharp prickly leaves. Okay? Since it's painful and unpleasant to hold, it can't be the species that the Torah commanded us to take. So you hear what's going on here. Apparently, this hirduf tree is plated. The branches do cover, I'm sorry, the leaves do cover the entire branch. So why is it disqualified? And the Gemara says it can't be this branch because it would be unpleasant to have to hold such a branch because it would be prickly to the hands. So you see how here, how the concept of its ways as of ways are pleasantness are even there in helping us discern what type of branch we're talking about. It's an amazing thing. So we said it's supposed to guide the life of the individual, the nation. It's guided our history. It even oftentimes guides, it should always, but it's not always, it's always possible, but that it should always guide the way that mitzvahs are done. Okay. Questions, comments, alternate speeches? No. Okay. Finally, the Gemara says, why was the first Beis HaMikdash in the year 586, before the Common Era, why was the first Holy Temple destroyed? So the Gemara says, because amongst the Jewish people, there was Shfichas Damim, there was the taking of innocent life, Gilui Arayos, there was immoral behavior, Avodah Zarah, and there was idol worship. I don't know how far it was, how far and widespread it was, but the Gemara says that's the reason. It's based on verses in the prophets. What's the reason that the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed? Sinas Chinam, baseless hatred. That means people hated each other for no reason, or even if they had a reason, it was corny. Right? They stepped on my foot at Kiddush, at the dinner, they spilled schmaltz on my shoes, something like that, and you wind up, you hate somebody. We didn't have no reason. Did you see what that person, right? The first Beis HaMikdash was gone for 70 years. The second one is gone, so far, nearly 2,000 years, 1900 and change. So the Gemara says, go and see which is worse. Which has a worse effect? Baseless hatred? Hating somebody for no reason and not living with derech eretz and menschlichkeit? Or the cardinal sins? The cardinal sins may be a reason for the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed. But that was easier to fix. Apparently, this idea of sinas chinam, which we talk about all the time, I don't know what we do about it. Right? You see that that's much worse. The Gemara says they actually, it may have even been that they were pious on the outside. You would have come into a Jewish community, you would have seen people davening and learning and helping them out and giving rides to hospitals and and giving tzedakah. But underneath, there was this nastiness that was brewing. And their midos weren't worked out. One of the things I spoke about on the second day of Shavuos was that Ruth, when she converted, and there's much, much written, obviously, about the book of Ruth and her conversion and everything. One of the things that I spoke about, I don't want to go into detail of where we get this from, but Ruth had an ayin tova. Ruth had an eye and told me she had a good eye. Right? No, she didn't bat clean up for the Rockies. Right? She had a good eye, which means that she saw things in a positive way. And one of the things that we can do about that is giving people the benefit of the doubt. People who don't have a good eye are constantly concocting in their mind. Sometimes they're right, and usually they're wrong, what the other person's motives were. What the other person was thinking. They wanted to hurt me. They wanted to harm me. They're nasty. They're this, right? You got to have an ayin tova. It's one of the ways, if you find that you have an ayin tova, that you have a good eye, you will see, we will all see, that we won't have such negative feelings about people. Because we'll let it be water off a duck's back when something happens, and we think, oh, they didn't mean it, they didn't that, right? It doesn't mean you allow yourself to be stepped on, right? And it doesn't mean you allow yourself to be taken advantage of. But so many things in life that we get upset over, or we get upset over at people, not just things, we get upset over at people, are so unnecessary that if we would turn a switch on and be able to give people the benefit of the doubt, that would help us with our yashrus, with being straight, being straightforward. So we have to ask ourselves the question whether in mitzvahs that are between man and fellow man are our ways of pleasantness, and even in mitzvahs that are between man and God, we have to ask ourselves, are our ways of pleasantness? And finally, for today, I shared with you in the past when we were doing not the previous book, but the one before that, Everyday Holiness, when we were studying that one, I shared with you about the yeshiva in Nevarduk, in Lithuania. And they were very, very, very strong proponents of the study of Musar and living life with the ethics of Musar. But they did it differently, amongst other things, they did things differently than all the other yeshivas. And I'll give you, they would walk around the streets and people would think they were a little crazy. They would walk into a hardware store and ask for milk, right? They would walk into a grocery store and ask for nails. And people thought they were crazy. What are you doing here? This is a grocery store. We don't sell nails here, right? What was the idea behind that? If indeed you're not supposed to see them, and these were yeshiva students, right? These were yeshiva bachur. So there are a couple of things over here that I find interesting, because nobody that I know of, I don't mean personally, but no movement that I know of within Torah Judaism practices that type of ethical development today. What does that have to do with ethical development? Like, what does a mishigas like that have to do with ethical development? Because, you see, today, some people like yeshiva students, some people don't like yeshiva students, some people are neutral about yeshiva students. I'm talking about in the Jewish world, yeah? You admire yeshiva students, some people admire them greatly. But the yeshiva student isn't hated. The yeshiva student generally isn't reviled. Even in Israel, I mean, there's an issue that they have with the draft law, but I hope not, that the yeshiva student per se is hated. And if he is, it's only because of the issues with the draft. In the years before World War I and World War II in Europe, the yeshiva bacher in the non-Torah world was the scum of the earth. People disliked them. They said, what are you wasting your time? People who didn't understand the value of Torah. One of the things, for instance, that I try to do here is when we get people who are here, even if they're not studying Torah themselves, right? I speak about it frequently, to get people to understand the value of what a yeshiva is, of what a kollel is, of what it means to study Torah. It's part of the education that I try to share with you, with other people out there. So in the Vardak, the idea was that if they could make themselves immune to people's mocking them with silly things, like I said, like in the grocery store, in the hardware store, then when people make fun of them for davening, when people make fun of them for studying Torah, for people making fun of them for wearing tzitzis, whatever it might be, it won't bother them. It's an interesting way of doing things. I'm, not highly on my recommend list, not high up on my recommended list. Nevertheless, this is what they did in the Vardik. So, in a situation like that, where, as we said before, let's say when it comes to putting on tefillin and there won't be time later in the day, So sometimes, even if people think you're strange or you're funny, or even if they think you're crazy, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Right? The times in the Vardic were different. The times in Lithuania were different. The world was different. Right? They were mocking them and making fun of them anyway. So they, you know. So this was, again, I don't think that would work today. And in my opinion, and I could be wrong, it's not necessary today. Because that people, again, not everybody thinks that Torah learning is of the highest value. I mean, people, you know, there are college students here, and there are college students here, and here, they're looking at them all as rabbinic students. Anybody who goes to yeshiva is in call, automatically they're called rabbi, even though it's not necessarily so. Well, if you already have the title before your name, rabbi, hoo, 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 you know. Now we can really go get it, right? So, but the idea is that as Jews, when it comes to doing the right thing, we have to do, and we should do, and we should be proud to show that we're Jewish and we're going to do the right thing, even if the world mocks us. But you don't have to do things that are not required of you because of your own stringency or because of your own carelessness that are going to cause people to mock you for doing what's right. That's also Derech Eretz. So you can do what's right and do what's required of you, and on your own time and place, if you think it requires an extra stringency or extra steps, or really, I want to show my devotion to it, I want to do more, that's fine. But not at the expense of someone else, or at the expense of making someone else think that Jews are idiots. Right? So let's just say, as an example, you're in a room and everybody's speaking Lashon Hara. You know, when you're sitting there playing cards, or just sitting around the table and schmoozing and speaking Lashon Hara, and people are speaking Lashon Hara, it can be very, very, very difficult to pick yourself up and, you know, and walk away. Some people are not up to the task. So then, what to do? I don't know, you make noise, you sing, you try to change the topic, whatever it is, right? But even if people think, oh, look at him, he's walking out because he doesn't want to hear Lashon Hara. What a frummy, right? Yeah, that's okay. That's not making a fool of yourself. Sitting around and listening to people gossip is wrong. And even if they'll think, what an idiot, he left the conversation, that's the right thing to do. I know it's a difficult challenge. I picked a hard one, yeah? It's a hard thing to do. Lashon Hara is a big one. And listening to it in some ways is worse than speaking it. You allowed it to promulgate, to spread even further if the speaker has an audience. Yeah?
I belong to a small meditation group of women.
That doesn't talk.
Well, it was Jewish and not. Mm-hmm. But this woman... woman who lived, she wasn't Jewish, but she lived these things, and when she heard someone starting to talk, she would quietly say, "Ladies, we're not going that way."
What a wonderful thing. I mean, I wish we all had the courage to do that. It's a wonderful thing.
We're not going that way.
So my point is just in conclusion today that we have to be able to discern between people making fun of me when I'm doing the right thing or people making fun of me when I'm doing the right thing and then I do things that are not really necessary and that causes them to laugh at me. Those things are not necessary to be done. So even in the performance of mitzvahs between man and God, between man and fellow man, whatever it is, we have to incorporate that element of Derech Eretz and Menschlichkeit in that as well. Okay, thanks.